eyes and shield their heads and wait. It takes a few moments to realize nothing is going to happen. The first soldiers who pop their heads up see the camel tearing ass away from them, the empty soup can bouncing harmlessly behind it, end over end. They watch the camel half gallop, half stagger into the immense desert horizon, overtaken eventually by the shimmers coming off the sand. The EODs have removed their helmets and are walking back toward the company, cursing loudly. Bishop stands next to Chucky, watching the camel race away.
"Fuck, man," Chucky says. "It's okay. That was too close. It wasn't your fault. You didn't mean to. It's like everything slowed down. I was just like..." He says, and he puts his palms up by his eyes, indicating a total narrowing and tunneling of his vision. "I mean, I was in it."
"In what?"
"The war hall," Chucky says. "I get it now. That was it."
And they think that's the end of the story. A bizarre one to tell back home. One of those surreal moments that present themselves during war. But just as everyone is getting comfortable back in their positions and the convoy begins to rumble forward, and they've been driving maybe 30 seconds, suddenly from inside the Bradley, Bishop feels a jolt and a wave of heat and hears that crack-boom sound of something in front of them exploding. It's that sound in the desert, they can hear it from miles. The worst sound of the war. The sound that will later make them all flinch, even when they've been home for years, whenever a balloon pops or fireworks explode. Because it will remind them of this. The sound of a mine, or IED. The sound of violent, gruesome, random death. And now comes the panic and the screaming. And Bishop pushes his way up to the turret and stands next to Chucky and sees how the Bradley in front of them is on fire, this tar-black smoke rolling out of it as one by one soldiers climb out, bleeding and dazed. The front of the Bradley seems to have been cracked in half right at the spot where the driver would have been sitting. One soldier is being carried away by two others, his leg attached by only bare red ribbons at the knee, swinging like a fish on a line. Baby Daddy is already calling for helicopters.
"The soup can," Bishop says. "Must have been a decoy. So we let our guard down."
And he turns to Chucky and knows right away by Chucky's look of terror and panic that something is wrong. Chucky holds his hands over his belly, clutching the wound. Bishop pulls the hands back and doesn't see anything.
"There's nothing here, Chuck."
"I felt it. I felt something go in."
He is already turning pale. Bishop sits him in the belly of the Bradley and pops open his jacket to reveal the body armor underneath and still sees nothing.
"Look, you're all armored up. You're fine."
"Trust me. It's there."
And so he pulls off the armor with Chucky moaning and peels off his undershirt, and there it is. Exactly where he said it would be. A few inches above his belly button, a dime-sized spot of blood. Bishop wipes it away and sees a small cut underneath, maybe the size of a large splinter, and laughs.
"Jesus, Chucky, you're all worked up about this."
"Is it bad?"
"You dumb motherfucker."
"It's not bad?"
"It's tiny. You're fine. You're an asshole."
"I don't know, man. There's something wrong."
"There's nothing wrong. Shut the fuck up."
"It feels like there's something very not right here."
So Bishop stays with him, insisting everything is okay and suggesting he stop being such a pussy, while Chucky keeps saying that something doesn't feel right, and they stay like that until they hear the thumping of the helicopters, at which point Chucky says very quietly,
"Hey, Bishop, listen. I have something to tell you."
"Okay."
"You know about my girlfriend, Julie Winterberry?"
"Yeah?"
"She's not my girlfriend. I made that up. She doesn't even know who I am. I only talked to her once. I asked her for her picture. It was the last day of school. Everyone was trading pictures."
"Oh, man, you're going to be sorry you said that."
"Listen, I made it up because every day I think about not talking to her."
"This is good info. This might be new nickname worthy.
I regret it so much, not talking to her.
Seriously, you are never going to hear the end of this.
Listen, if I don't make it,
you will be taking shit for this literally nonstop forever.
If I don't make it, I want you to find Julie and tell her how I really feel. I want her to know.
Seriously, it will last the rest of your life. I will call you when you are 80 years old and make fun of you about Julie Winterberry.
Just promise.
Fine, I promise. Chucky nods and closes his eyes until the medics come and take him on a stretcher and into the helicopter, and they all disappear into the dull copper sky. Then the rest of the convoy continues its loud, slow journey. What happens that night is that Chucky dies. A piece of shrapnel only about half an inch long and as thin as the straw in a juice box had clipped the artery feeding his liver, and by the time doctors figured it out, he'd lost too much blood and was in full-blown acute liver failure. Baby Daddy is the one to tell them the next day, right before going out in sector. "Now forget about it," he says when it becomes clear the news is going to interfere with their concentration on the upcoming patrol. "If the Army wanted us to have emotions, they would have issued us some." And it's a quiet and subdued and uneventful evening, and the whole time Bishop feels angry. Angry at Chucky's senseless death and the fuckers who planted that bomb, but also angry at Chucky's cowardice, that he could never say what he needed to say to Julie Winterberry, that a man who could rush into dark rooms where people with machine guns wanted to kill him was unable to talk to a stupid girl. These two kinds of courage seem so different they ought to have separate words. That night he can't sleep. He broods. His anger has twisted so that he is no longer angry at Chucky, but rather angry at himself, because he and Chucky are no different. Because Bishop has terrible things inside him that he cannot bring himself to tell anyone. The great evil secret of his life. Sometimes it feels so big it's like he needs a new inner organ to contain it. The secret sits inside him and devours him. It devours time and grows stronger as time passes so that now when he thinks of it, he cannot separate the event itself from his later revulsion of it. What happened with the headmaster? The man whom everyone revered and loved. The headmaster. Bishop loved him too, and when in fifth grade he picked Bishop for tutoring, for extra weekend lessons that absolutely had to be kept secret because the other boys would be jealous, it made 10-year-old Bishop feel so special and wanted, picked out of the crowd, admired and loved. And how he shudders at it now, years later, that he was so easily tricked, that he never questioned the headmaster, not even when he told Bishop that their lessons would be about what to do with girls, because all the boys were terrified of girls and didn't know what to do with girls, and Bishop felt really lucky he had someone to show him. It started with photographs from magazines, men and women both, together, separate, nude. Then Polaroid pictures. Then the headmaster suggesting they take Polaroids of each other. Bishop remembers only fragments, images, moments. The headmaster gently helped Bishop out of his clothes, and still Bishop did not think this was wrong. He did everything willingly. He let the headmaster touch him, first with his hands, then with his mouth. Afterward telling Bishop how wonderful and handsome and special he was. The headmaster saying after a few months of this, "Now you try it on me." The headmaster disrobing, the first time Bishop saw him, red and swollen and strongly persuasive. Bishop trying to do on the headmaster what the headmaster had done on him, and doing so awkwardly, clumsily. The headmaster getting frustrated and angry for the first time when Bishop's teeth accidentally got involved, grabbing Bishop by the back of the head and thrusting and saying, "No, like this!" and later apologizing at the tears that arrive when Bishop's gag reflex engaged. Bishop feeling like this was his fault, that he would practice and do it better next time. Then doing no better next time, nor the next time. One day the headmaster stopping him halfway through and turning him around and leaning over him and saying, We'll have to do this the way adults do it. You're an adult, right? And Bishop nodding his head because he didn't want to be bad at this anymore, didn't want the headmaster to be angry anymore. So when the headmaster positioned himself behind Bishop and pushed himself in, Bishop endured it. The horror of it now, these images cascading back to Bishop, so many years later and 10,000 miles away in a desert, in a war. Bishop thinking how even this secret has another secret, a deeper and more devastating layer. The thing that made him sure he was evil and broken, which is that while the headmaster was doing what he was doing, Bishop liked it. He looked forward to it. He wanted it. And not only because of how it made him feel wanted and special and unique and picked out of the crowd, but also because what the headmaster did to him, especially at first, felt good. It jolted his body in a way nothing else did, a way that he loved while it was happening and missed when it stopped, the headmaster abruptly canceling their lessons in the spring. And Bishop felt rejected and abandoned and realized all at once sometime in early April that the headmaster had taken up with a new boy. Bishop could tell by the looks they shared in the hallway and how the new boy had recently turned sullen and quiet. And this made Bishop furious. He began acting out in school, talking back to the nuns, getting into fights. When he was finally expelled, he was sitting with his parents in the headmaster's office, and the headmaster said, "I'm very sorry it came to this." And there were so many layers of meaning to this that Bishop just laughed. He began poisoning the headmaster's hot tub the next week. And this is the part that horrifies him most now, how he tried to get back at the headmaster like a jilted girlfriend. How he would have stopped behaving badly if the headmaster had only taken him back, invited him in. It's horrifying because he can't tell himself now that he was an innocent victim. He feels more like an accomplice in his own perversion. It was an evil that happened, and he wanted it to happen. The full consequence of this didn't reveal itself until later, in adolescence, at military school, where the worst thing in the world was to be a queer or faggot, and if anyone called another boy a queer or faggot or gay wad or homo, he would routinely want to fight. And the way the boys showed everyone else they weren't queers or faggots was to make fun of others for being huge queers and faggots, and to do so loudly. This became Bishop's calling card. He was especially ruthless to his roommate sophomore year, a slightly effeminate boy named Brandon. Whenever Brandon walked into the communal shower, Bishop would say something like, "Careful, boys, don't drop your soap." Or before going to bed, he'd ask, "Do I have to put duct tape over my asshole tonight, or can you behave yourself?" Things like that. The typical late 80s jock type harassment. Nicknames included Ass Pirate and Daisy, as in Eyes Forward Daisy, when they were standing next to each other at the urinals. Brandon eventually left the school, which was a relief to Bishop, who had developed powerful longings for Brandon that had become almost physically painful. How he watched as Brandon undressed, watched him in class hovering intently and dutifully over his notes, chewing on a pencil. But that was so many years ago, and in all this time he's never told anyone. And he suddenly jolts up in his bed on this, the day that Chucky has died, and he decides he needs to write a letter. Because Chucky was killed with so many secrets still inside him that his dying wish was to let them out, and Bishop does not want to feel the same when his time comes. He wants to have more courage than that. He decides he'll write to everyone in his life. He'll write his sister, apologizing for becoming so distant, explaining that he detached because he was damaged, because the headmaster must have flipped some switch inside him, and now he felt so much rage at the headmaster for doing this to him, and at himself for being so awful and perverted and deviant and unfixably broken. He was trying to protect her. He would tell Bethany. He didn't want to break her, too. And he'll write his parents. And Brandon. He'll track down Brandon and ask his forgiveness. Even mighty Andy Berg, whom he never saw again after trapping the poor kid in a stairwell and pissing on him. Even the Berg needs a letter. He'll do one every night until all his secrets are laid bare. He fetches some army stationery,
sits in the barren and concrete-walled break room lit fluorescently green. He'll write to Samuel first, he decides, because he knows exactly what he wants to say, and it will be a short letter, and already it's very deep into the night, and he has to be awake again in a few hours. So he begins, and in a flare of inspiration and focus, he finishes the letter in under 5 minutes. And he folds it up and places it inside an official U.S. Army envelope and licks it closed and writes Samuel's full, obnoxiously hyphenated name on the outside and places it in his locker with all his other personal effects. He feels good about it, about getting that off his chest and out into the world. And he feels good about his new project, about letting go of the things that have been bundled up inside him all these years. He feels like he's actually looking forward to writing the letters to his sister and his parents and the various friends he's abandoned along the way. And he falls asleep feeling really good about these letters, not knowing that they will never be written. Because tomorrow he will be out on patrol and he'll be thinking about Julie Winterberry, who obviously also needs a letter. When a trash can will explode a few feet away from him, remote detonated by someone watching from a second-story window way down the street, someone who doesn't really see Bishop, but rather sees only his uniform, who has stopped recognizing anyone wearing that uniform as anything remotely human, who, if he could have heard what was going through Bishop's head at that moment, as Bishop tried to mentally compose a letter to a beautiful girl back home about a dead friend who loved her, would have never exploded that bomb. But of course we can't ever do this, hear these things. So the bomb exploded. And the force of the bomb propelled Bishop into the air, where for a moment everything was quiet and cold, and the feeling of being inside the bomb's blast was like being inside one of his mother's snow globes. Everything around him moving, as though through thick liquid, hanging there, suspended in its way beautiful, before the bomb shattered everything inside him and all his senses went dark, and Bishop's body, no longer containing in any meaningful way Bishop himself, crashed into the street many meters away, and for the second time that week someone died while thinking about Julie Winterberry, who was 10,000 miles away at that moment and probably wishing that something exciting would finally happen to her. The Army collected his things and sent them to his parents, who found the letter addressed to Samuel Anderson Anderson, and remembered that was the strange name of their daughter's childhood pen pal, and so they gave the letter to Bethany, and she struggled many months before deciding she would finally give the letter to you. And so this is how the letter traveled from a classified village somewhere in Iraq to this kitchen counter in downtown Manhattan, where it looks spotlighted by one of the kitchen's overhead recessed lights. You pick it up. It's almost weightless. A single page inside, which you remove. He's only written a few paragraphs. You sense that your big decision is approaching. It's a decision that will shape you and go on shaping you for years. You read the letter. Dear Samuel, the human body is so fragile. It's ruined by the smallest things. You can put 20 bullets into a camel and it will just keep coming for you. But half an inch of shrapnel is enough to kill us plain little people. Our bodies are the thin knife's edge separating us from oblivion. I am beginning to accept this. If you're reading this, then something has happened to me, and so I have a favor to ask. You and I did a terrible thing together that morning by the pond. The day your mother left. The day the police came. I'm sure you remember. What we did that morning to each other is terrible and unforgivable. I was corrupted, and I corrupted you too. And this corruption, I've discovered, does not go away. It stays with you and poisons you. It's with you for life. I'm sorry, but it's true. I know you love Bethany. I love her too. She is good in a way I have never been good. She's not broken the way we are. I'd ask you to keep it this way. This is my dying wish, the only thing I ask of you. For her sake, for my sake, please, stay away from my sister. And so you've arrived. It's finally the moment to make your choice. To your right is the door to the bedroom, where Bethany waits for you. To your left, the elevator door and the whole great empty world. It's time. Make a decision. Which door do you choose? Part 6. Invasive Species. Late Summer 2011. 1. Ponage opened the refrigerator door, then closed the refrigerator door. He stood in his kitchen, trying really hard to remember the reason he came in here, but he couldn't come up with it. He checked his email. He tried logging on to World of Elfscape, but could not. It was Tuesday. He thought about going outside to the mailbox to get the mail, but did not end up going outside because the mail might not have been delivered yet, and he didn't want to make two trips. He looked across his front lawn at the mailbox, trying to judge whether there was mail in it by staring. He closed the door. He felt like something needed his attention in the kitchen, but did not know what. He opened the refrigerator and looked at every item in the fridge, hoping one of them would serve as a kind of trigger for the thing he was supposed to remember about the kitchen. He saw the jars of pickles and plastic squeeze bottles of ketchup and mayonnaise and a bag of flaxseed he bought once in a moment of diet optimism, but had not yet opened. There were 5 eggplants on the bottom shelf, clearly mushioning from the inside, slowly collapsing in on themselves. 5 little purple pillows with small pools of biscuit-colored juice gathering under them. In the produce drawer, his various greens were brown and wilted. So were the cobs of corn on the top shelf, which were a sickly ecru, every kernel having lost its ripe yellow puffiness and shriveled into roughly the shape of a diseased human molar. He closed the refrigerator door. What happened on Tuesdays was that the World of Elfscape game servers were taken offline for most of the morning and sometimes part of the afternoon, for regular maintenance and bug fixes, and whatever genius-level technical things were required of computers, that otherwise ran 24 hours a day and hosted 10 million game players simultaneously, with almost no network lag using some of the most ruthlessly secure encryption on the planet. Servers so fast and efficient and mighty that they put to shame the machines now being used by the space program, or in nuclear missile silos, or in voting booths, for example. How a country that made World of Elfscape servers could not make a functional electronic voting machine was a question often posed on Election Day Tuesdays on the Elfscape message boards, while the gaming community patiently waited for the servers to come back online and sometimes also voted. Some of these Tuesdays, though, were very special and particularly agonizing Tuesdays known as Patch Days, when the engineers added some kind of game update so that the next time players logged on, there would be new things to do. New quests, achievements, monsters, treasure. Such patches were necessary to keep the game fresh and interesting. But of course, patch days had the longest game downtime because of the elaborate things being done to the game servers and coding. It was not unheard of for the servers to be down all morning and all afternoon and sometimes, to the dismay of the game community, into the early evening. And this was happening today. The game was being patched. It was patch day. And not knowing exactly when the servers would come back online made Ponage feel stressed out. Which was a bit of a paradox because the ostensible reason he played Elfscape was because it so effectively relieved his stress. It was where he turned when he felt too encumbered by the wearying details of his life. It all began about a year ago, just after Lisa left, one day when he felt the stress coming on particularly strong, and none of the DVDs seemed very good, and nothing was on TV, and nothing in his online movie queue seemed interesting, and all the console games he owned had been beaten and discarded, and he felt this weird panicky sensation, like when you're at a good restaurant but nothing seems appetizing. Or like when you're first starting to come down with a cold or a flu, and not even water tastes good. That kind of all-encompassing negative darkness, where the whole world seems boring and tedious, and you feel this global weariness. And he was sitting in his living room in the gathering darkness of an evening just after daylight saving time ended, so it was unusually gray, at a depressingly early time of day. And he was sitting there realizing he was about to have a direct frontal head-on collision with the stress that
that if he did not find a diversion quickly, he was definitely going to get worked up to a degree that would spell certain trouble for his blood pressure and general circulatory system health, and what he usually did when this happened was to go to the electronics store and buy something, this time about a dozen video games, one of which was World of Elfscape. And since beginning with an elf warrior named Ponage, he had advanced to play a whole stable of alternate characters with names like Ponopoly and Ponalicious and Poner and Edgar Allan Pone, and he made a name for himself as a fearsome gladiatorial opponent and a very strong and capable raid leader, directing a large group of players in a fight against a computer-controlled enemy in what he came to regard as being a conductor in a battle symphony ballet type of thing, and he rather quickly got extraordinarily good at this, since being good required all manner of research, watching online videos of relevant battles and reading the forums and sifting through the numbers of the theory crafting websites to see which stat was most useful during certain fights, such that he had slightly different gear and weapon combos for every fight in the game, each of them designed to mathematically maximize his death-dealing ability for that particular engagement, because he believed if he was going to do something, he was going to do it right. He would give 110%, a work ethic he liked to think would soon help him with his kitchen renovation and novel writing and new diet plans, but which so far seemed to apply only in the area of video games. He created more characters and more accounts that he would play simultaneously on several computers, each of these new accounts requiring the purchase of a new computer, new game DVD, expansion pack, and monthly subscription fee, which meant that whenever he felt the need to create another character, usually because all his other characters were at the very highest level and were as good as they could possibly be, and he was getting bored with dominating the game so thoroughly and the boredom would set off his stress alarms and so something had to be done immediately, it was such a massive capital outlay that he felt absolutely beholden to play the game even more, even if he was dimly aware of the irony here that the stress of his deplorable financial situation created the need for all of these electronic stress relievers, the expense of which created more of the very same stress he was trying to avoid in the first place, which made it seem like his current level of electronic distraction was now failing, and so he sought out newer and ever more expensive distractions, thereby magnifying the stress and guilt cycle, a bit of a consumerist psychological trap that he frequently noted among Lisa's customers at the Lancome counter, whose purchases of makeup only reinforced the central unattainable beauty illusion that drove them to buy makeup in the first place. But for some reason, he could not spot in himself. He checked the Elfscape servers, still down. It was like waiting out an airline delay, he thought, that urgency one felt at the airport, knowing people who love you are waiting at another airport, and the only thing keeping you from them is some intractable failure of technology. It felt like that, these patch days. Whenever he logged on after hours of delay, it felt like he'd gone home. It was hard to ignore this feeling. It was hard not to feel conflicted about it. It was a little troubling that when he thought about the vistas of Elfscape, the animated, digitally rendered rolling hills and misty forests and mountaintops and such, they struck him with the force of real memory. That he had a nostalgia and fondness for these places that outpaced the fondness he had for the real places in his life. This was complicated for him, because he knew in some way the game was all false and illusory, and the places he remembered didn't really exist except as digital code stored on his computer's hard drive. But then he thought about this time he climbed to the top of a mountain on the northern edge of Elfscape's western continent, and watched the moon rise over the horizon, watched the moonlight sparkle off the snow, and he thought it was beautiful. And he thought about how people talked about feeling transported by works of art, standing in front of paintings feeling hopelessly persuaded by their beauty. And he decided there was really no difference between their experience and his experience. Sure, the mountain wasn't real, the moonlight wasn't real, but the beauty and his memory of it, that was real. And so patch days were a unique horror because he was cut off from his source of wonder and beauty and surprise and was forced sometimes for a whole day to confront his normal everyday analog existence. And all week he'd been thinking about how to occupy his Tuesday so that the intolerable gap between waking up and logging on was more tolerable. Things to do that would make the time go by more quickly. He started a list on his smartphone, a patch day to-do list, so that he could record any thought he might have during the week regarding ways to make patch day more pleasant and endurable. The list contained, so far, 3 items. 1. Buy health food. 2. Help Dodger. 3. Discover great literature. That last item had been on his to-do list every week for 6 months, ever since he saw a sign at a nearby mega bookstore that said, "Discover great literature," and he put it on the list. He told the phone to repeat it, to put it on every weekly list thereafter, because he'd always wanted to be a reader, and he thought the whole curled up snugly all afternoon with a cup of tea and a good book thing was a really excellent image to project about oneself online. Plus, if Lisa ever happened to secretly check his phone's to-do list in a moment of curiosity or obsessional divorce regret, he was pretty sure she would approve of Discover Great Literature and maybe realize he was really changing as a person and want to take him back. However, in 6 months, he had discovered no literature whatsoever, great or otherwise, and every time he thought about discovering great literature, the effort made him feel tired, spent, boggy-headed. So then there was item number 1. Buy health food. He had tried this already. Last week, he had finally entered the organic grocery store after having cased it from the street for several days, watching people go in and out and quietly judging them for their yuppie elitist privileged lifestyle and their skinny hipster clothes and electric cars. It seemed necessary for him to construct an elaborate mental bulwark like this before even entering the organic grocery store, because the more he sat in his car outside the store, judging the customers, the more he was convinced they were judging him too. That he wasn't hip enough, or fit enough, or rich enough to shop there. In his mind, he was the protagonist of every story, the center of everyone's appalling attention. He was on display and out of place. The store was a panopticon of sneering, abusive judgment. He carried on long imaginary dialogues with the idealistic cashiers who were the gatekeepers between the food and the exits, explaining to them how he wasn't shopping there because it was the trendy thing to do, but rather because it was coldly, absolutely, medically necessary according to the rules of his radical new diet plan. And whereas the other customers were there only out of fidelity to some hip movement, like the organic movement or the slow food movement or the locavore movement or whatever, he was there because he needed to be there, making him actually a more authentic shopper than they were, even if he did not per se fit the image of the typical customer according to the store's elaborate branding campaign. And so after several dozen of these practice dialogues, he felt prepared and strong-willed enough to enter the grocery store, where he crept around and very quietly purchased the exact organic replicas of what he usually bought at the 7-Eleven down the street. Canned soups, canned meat products, white bread, energy bars, frozen and reheatable pizza and dinner things. And when he was unloading his cart at the checkout, he felt a brief surge of belongingness, that nobody had challenged his presence there or really even looked at him twice. That is, until the cashier, this cute girl with hip square glasses who was probably a grad student in ecology or social justice or something like that, looked at his boxed and frozen and canned food items and said, "Looks like you're stocking up for a hurricane." And then laughed lightly as if to say, "Just kidding," before booping the stuff over the laser scanner. And he smiled and half-heartedly chuckled, but could not shake for the rest of the day the feeling of having been judged harshly by the cashier, who was not so subtly telling him his food purchases were unfit for consumption except in the most dire circumstances, such as apocalypse. Point taken. On his next visit, he bought only fresh things. Fruits, vegetables, meats wrapped in wax paper. Only things perishable, easily spoilable. And even though he had no earthly idea how to prepare the food, he felt healthier just buying it. Just having it nearby. Having people see him with it. Like being on a date with someone extraordinarily attractive. How you want to go to public places with that person? He felt the same about his cart, full of shiny eggplants, and corn, and various green-growing things. Arugula, broccoli, Swiss chard. It was so beautiful,
And when he presented his food to this same cute cashier at the front of the store, he felt like a child giving his mother a card he made at school.
"Did you bring it back?" she said.
He stared at her, not fully comprehending the question. "Bag for what?"
"No," he said.
"Oh," she said, disappointed. "We encourage all our customers to bring reusable bags, you know, to save paper."
"Okay."
"Plus you get a rebate," she said. "For every bag you bring, you get a rebate."
He nodded. He was no longer looking at her. He was instead looking at the cash register's video screen. He was pretending to very carefully analyze the price of each food item to ensure he wasn't overcharged. The cashier must have sensed his unease and his feeling of having been scolded again, and so tried to defuse the situation with a change of subject.
"What are you going to do with all this eggplant?"
But this did not defuse the situation at all, because the only answer he was capable of giving was the true one.
"I don't know." And then when the cashier girl seemed sort of disappointed by this answer, he added, "Maybe, like, a soup?"
This was so fucking unbearable, he couldn't even shop correctly.
He went home and found a website that sold reusable grocery bags, some outfit that used the proceeds from all their bag sales to do something good in some rainforest somewhere. More important, this outfit's logo was printed prominently on both sides of the bag, so that when he gave the bags to the cashier, she would see the logo and be impressed by it, since not only was he being a good environmentalist customer by bringing his own bags, but the bags themselves also did good environmental things, making him twice as pro-nature as any of the shoppers in the store. He had the bag shipped next day air. He went back to the store. He bought perishable fresh foods again, but only one of each kind. No overbuying one item and drawing attention to it a la eggplant. He got in the line of the cute cashier girl with the square black glasses. She said, "Hi," but it was a generic greeting. She did not remember their connection. She scanned and tallied his groceries. She said, "Did you bring a bag?" And he said, casually, like it was no big deal and totally something he did all the time, "Oh, sure, I brought a bag."
"Do you want to keep the rebate?" she said, "or donate it?"
"Do what?"
"You get a rebate for bringing a bag."
"I know that."
"Would you like to donate it to one of our 15 approved charities?"
And here he reflexively said, "No." But it wasn't because he was stingy and wouldn't genuinely want a charity to have his rebate. It was because he knew he would have no idea how to choose among the 15 charities, probably never having heard of any of them. So he declined because that seemed the smoothest, least embarrassing way to proceed and be done with the social encounter that, to be honest, had eaten up a lot of his spare brain power all week, envisioning it, preparing for it.
"Oh," said the cashier, surprised. "Okay, well, fine."
With a kind of upturned lip and sarcastic eyebrow flare that conveyed something along the lines of, "Aren't we being an asshole today?" She continued swiping his food across the scanner and weighing his fruits and vegetables in what he interpreted as a cold and mechanical manner. Fingers flew over the register buttons quickly and expertly. She was so comfortable here, so at home. She did not feel one bit of anxiety about her lifestyle or opinions. She so easily judged and dismissed him, and he felt something inside him sort of break. Something curdled and sour, a fury he felt all the way to his liver. And he raised the empty cloth reusable grocery bag over his head, and he held it that way for a moment, maybe waiting for someone to say something. But no one did. No one paid an ounce of attention to him. And this seemed like the worst insult of all. That he was standing in this theatrical pose of violence and passion, and no one cared. So he threw it, the bag, he threw it point blank, right at the cashier's feet. And as he threw it, he made a war cry of wild anger. Or at least, he'd meant to. What actually came out was a garbled and low kind of gruff animal noise. He grunted. The bag struck the cashier sidelong in the hip region. And she let out a sharp, surprised cry and jumped backward as the bag crumpled and fell loosely to the floor. She stared at him with her mouth open, and he stepped toward her and leaned over the cash register and opened his arms wide as a condor and yelled, "You know what?" He did not know why he was opening his arms this way. He realized he didn't have anything on tap mentally with which to follow that question. The store had suddenly gone terribly quiet, the usual register area beeping noises having stopped at the cashier's first shriek. He looked around him. He saw faces aghast, mostly women staring at him scornful and outraged. He backed slowly away from the cashier. He felt he needed to say something to the crowd, to explain the offense that provoked him, to justify his outburst, to communicate his innocence and righteousness and virtue. What came out was, "You have got to represent!" He didn't know why he said that. He remembered hearing it in that pop song recently, that Molly Miller song. He liked the sound of it when he heard it in that song. He thought it was edgy and hip. But as soon as he said it out loud, he realized he had no idea what it meant. He quickly left, jammed his hands into his pockets, and speed-walked out the door. He vowed never to return. That store, that cashier, you could never be good enough for them. There was no pleasing those people. So item number one, buy health food, that was a non-starter. There was still one thing he could check off his list on this patch day. Help Dodger. And to be honest, this seemed like the most attractive option anyway. Helping his guildmate, his brand new friend, his Earl friend, was the term used among some Elfscape players, IRL being the community's popular acronym for In Real Life, a place they talked about as if it were another country far away. And he wanted to pretend the primary reason he found this option most appealing was because of some altruistic impulse to help friends in need. And that impulse might have been in there somewhere, part of the stew, but if he really thought about it, he'd say the real reason was that his new friend was a writer. Dodger had a book contract, a publisher, access to the deeply mysterious book world that Ponage needed, because Ponage was a writer too. And while he had been talking with his new friend that night at Jezebel's, he had trouble focusing completely because as soon as he discovered his new friend was a writer, he kept thinking about his psychic detective serial killer novel, which he was sure was a million-dollar book. He'd begun the story in high school in his junior year creative writing class. He wrote the first 5 pages the night before it was due. The teacher had written that he'd done a great job and that he'd captured the voice of the detective effectively. And in the margins during a certain scene where the detective had a vision of the killer stabbing a girl in the heart, the teacher wrote, "Scary!" And this confirmed that Ponage could do very special things. He could ignite a real emotional response with something he wrote hastily in one night. It was a gift. You had it, or you didn't. Helping his new Earl friend, he decided, would give him the motivation to finally do everything he needed to do. Because Dodger would then owe him a favor, which he could cash in to find a publisher and receive his huge book contract, which would not only dig him out of the hole he was in mortgage-wise, and not only allow him the budget to buy actual organic health food and renovate the kitchen, but would also convince Lisa to come back, knowing as he did that one of her main complaints about him was his lack of initiative and drive, which she had spelled out with painful clarity in the irreconcilable differences portion of the paperwork that made their divorce agreement official. So, Dodger needed information about his mom, and his mom wasn't talking. He needed information about her past. But the only concrete things they had were a woefully incomplete arrest report and a photograph taken in 1968 of his mother at a protest. There was a girl sitting near her in the photo who maybe seemed part of her group, the one with the aviator shades. And Ponage wondered if she was still alive. Maybe she was, and maybe she still lived in Chicago. Or maybe she had friends still living in Chicago. All he needed were names. He texted the photograph to Axeman, a level 90 elf warrior in the guild who IRL was a high school senior who was really good at writing code but terrible at playing sports. Unfortunately, the only thing his father cared about. Axeman's programming specialty was something he called social bombing, where he was able to get his message almost simultaneously on every blog comment thread and wiki page and community network and message board on the internet. This was almost certainly worth a lot of money to someone, this software, yet Axeman had only used it so far to exact revenge on the jocks who picked on him at school, photoshopping their faces into explicit scenes from gay pornography, usually, and then spamming the resulting real-looking image to 500 million people. It was still in beta, Axeman said of his application. He said he still needed to figure out how to monetize it, though Ponage suspected he was just waiting to turn 18 and move out of the house so he didn't have to share his millions with his asshole dad. So anyway, Ponage sent Axeman the photograph along with a quick note. Spam the Chicago boards. I want to know who this woman is. And Ponage sat back and felt really excellent about this. And even though it took him maybe a minute or two tops, he felt mentally exhausted by the effort. Coming up with the plan. Executing the plan. He felt spent. Done for the day. Stressed out. He tried logging on to Elfscape, but the servers were still down. He looked out the front window at the mailbox. He sat down in a chair to decide what to do next. Then stood and sat in a different chair because the other one was sort of uncomfortable. He stood again and walked to the center of the room and played a quick little game in his mind where he tried to stand in the room's exact middle, perfectly equidistant from all four walls. He abandoned this game before he got to the point where he felt like getting out the tape measure to verify his accuracy. He thought about watching a movie, but he'd seen them all before, his entire collection, many times. He thought about buying and downloading some new movies, but the effort of looking seemed like it would make him feel tired. He walked to the back of the house, then to the front, hoping something in the house would trigger a thought. There was something in the kitchen he needed to do. He was sure of it. He could feel the memory of it dancing beyond his grasp. He opened the oven and closed it, opened the dishwasher and closed it. He opened the refrigerator, certain there was something in here that would remind him of the thing he was supposed to remember about the goddamn kitchen.
2. The thing is that Laura Potsdam had the feeling she was feeling a brand new emotion, like something she'd never felt before, which was totally weird. She sat alone in her messy dorm room and fiddled with her iFeel app and waited for Larry to arrive and felt, for the first time, this new thing. Doubt. Doubt about many things. Doubt right now about the iFeel app itself, which would not let her express her doubt. Doubt not being one of the 50 standard emotions available on iFeel. The app was letting her down. For the very first time, iFeel didn't know how she felt. I feel horrible, she wrote, then decided no, she did not feel that way. That wasn't quite accurate. Horrible was what she felt after she hurt her mother's feelings again, or after she ate. She did not feel horrible now. She deleted it. I feel lost, she wrote, but that sounded stupid and cheesy and definitely not a Laura thing to say. People who were lost were people with no direction in life, and she had direction in life, Laura did. Successful future vice president of communications and marketing, hello. Successful business major, elite college student. She deleted lost. I feel upset was wrong too, due to not seeming important enough. Delete. The thing about I Feel was that she could broadcast how she felt at any given moment to her huge network of friends, and then their apps could auto-respond to her feelings with whatever message was appropriate, given the emotion she expressed. And Laura usually loved this, how she could post I Feel sad, and within seconds her phone lit up with encouragement and support and pick-me-ups, and that made her feel actually less sad. She could select an emotion from the 50 standard emotion choices and post a little explanatory note or photo or both, then watch the support roll in. But now, for the first time, the 50 standard emotion choices seemed, to Laura, limited. For the first time, she did not seem to feel any of the standard emotions. And this was really surprising to her because she'd always thought 50 choices were sort of a lot.
And indeed, there were some emotions she had never expressed feeling. She had not once ever written, "I feel helpless," even though helpless was right there among the 50 standard emotions. She had never written, "I feel guilty," or "I feel ashamed." She had never written, "I feel old," obviously. She wasn't quite sad, nor was she miserable. It was more that she felt a kind of doubt that what she was thinking and feeling and doing wasn't exactly totally right. And this was really uncomfortable because it contradicted the primary message of her life, that everything she did was correct and praiseworthy, and whatever she wanted she should have because she deserved it, which was the more or less constant message from her mother, whom Laura called after the meeting with her intro to lit professor. "He thinks I cheated. He thinks I plagiarized a paper." "Did you?" her mother asked. "No," Laura said. Then after a long pause, "Actually, yes, I did cheat." "Well, I'm sure you had a good reason for it."
"I had an excellent reason for it," she said. Her mother had always done this, supplied her with good excuses.
Once, when she was 15 and she came home at 3 a.m, obviously drunk and maybe also a little stoned, dropped off by 3 very loud, very much older boys who had recently either graduated high school or dropped out of it, the hair on the back of her head tangled and disheveled from what had obviously been vigorous friction against the back seat upholstery of a car, in a state so near comatose that when her mother said, "Where have you been?" she could not think of anything to say and just stood there and dumbly wobbled. Even then, her mother had bailed her out.
"Are you sick?"
she asked Laura, who, taking the bait, nodded her head.
"You're sick, aren't you? You're coming down with something. You were probably taking a nap and lost track of time, right?"
"Yes," Laura said. "I don't feel well." Which, of course, required her to play hooky the next day to keep up the lie, claiming an unbearable cold and flu-like illness, which was not too much of a stretch given the top-shelf hangover she woke up with. The weirdest thing about these interactions was how much her mother seemed to believe them. It wasn't only that she was covering for her daughter, she seemed to be willfully hallucinating about her.
"You're a strong woman, and I'm proud of you," she'd tell Laura afterward, or, "You can have anything you want,"
or, "Don't let anyone get in your way," or,
"I gave up my career for you, and so your success literally means everything in the world to me,"
or whatever. But now Laura also felt doubt, which was not one of the 50 allowable emotions according to I Feel, which itself made her doubt that it was doubt she was feeling, a kind of mind-bending paradox she tried not to spend too much mental time with. She could not fail her intro to lit course. That much was clear. There were too many things at stake. Internships, summer jobs, grade point average, a besmirched permanent record. No, that could not happen. And she felt mistreated and wronged by her professor, who was willing to effectively take away her future because of one stupid assignment, which seemed to her a response all out of proportion to the crime she committed. But okay, even this she doubted. Because if it didn't matter if she cheated on any single assignment, and by extension, it would be okay if she cheated on every assignment. Which struck her as at least a little weird because the agreement she'd reached with herself in high school when all the cheating started was that it was okay to cheat on every assignment now as long as sometime in the future she stopped cheating and began doing the actual work as soon as the assignment started to matter. Which had not yet happened. In 4 years of high school and 1 year of college, she had not done anything that registered even remotely as mattering. So she cheated on everything and lied about it all the time and did not feel 1 ounce of regret. Not until today. What was screwing with her head today was this. What if she made it all the way through college, never having done any actual college work? When she got her very first powerful publicity and marketing job, would she know what to do? It struck her that she did not even fully comprehend what was involved in the word marketing, despite a low-level innate ability to recognize when someone else had done it well to her. But every time she thought about maybe paying attention in her classes and doing the work herself
and really studying for tests and writing her own papers, the fear that grabbed her was this. What if she couldn't do it? What if she wasn't good enough? Or smart enough? What if she failed? She worried that the Laura unaided by deception and duplicity was not the elite college student both she and her mother assumed her to be. For her mother, this knowledge would be crippling. Her mother, who since the divorce signed all her emails to Laura with, "You are my only joy," she could never handle Laura's failure. It would be like a nullification of her whole life's project. So Laura had to do this, press forward with her plan, however risky, for her mother's sake, for both their sakes. There was no room for doubt. Because the thing is that now the stakes were even higher. Her phone call to the dean had effectively relieved her of any Hamlet-related suffering, but it had caused an unexpected problem, which was that the dean was now going to extraordinary lengths to show how sensitive the university was to Laura's hurt feelings. The dean was organizing a mediation and conflict resolution conference, which, as far as Laura could tell, was a 2-day summit where she and Professor Anderson would sit across from each other at a table while several third-party peacemaker coaches would help them engage in, manage, cope with, and productively resolve their differences in a safe and respectful environment, which sounded like just about the worst thing in the world. Laura knew it would be difficult to maintain her fabrications over 2 days of intense scrutiny. She knew she had to prevent this meeting at all costs, but she felt doubt and maybe even a bit of guilt and remorse about the only solution she'd so far devised. There was a knock at the door. That, finally, would be Larry. "One second," she yelled. She pulled off her shorts and tank top, yanked off her bra and underwear, and fetched the towel from her closet. It was the thinnest, smallest towel she owned. It was probably not even a proper bath towel because it did not wrap fully around her, but rather revealed a long dagger of flesh all the way up her side. And the towel wasn't a standard width either, since the bottom came down only to that soft, fleshy, ticklish part where her legs met her torso. Any sudden movement and all would be revealed. In other words, it was white, threadbare from many washings, almost see-through in places. She had laundered it many times to achieve exactly this look. She used it roughly the same way a magician used a watch, to hypnotize. She opened the door. "Hey," she said, and Larry's eyes darted south the moment he saw her and comprehended her and her fantastically small towel. "I'm not dressed, sorry," she said. "I was just about to shower." He walked in and closed the door behind him. Larry Broxton, wearing his usual outfit, shiny silver basketball shorts, black t-shirt, big flip-flops. It was not that Larry didn't own any other clothes. He did. She'd seen his closet, filled with nice-looking button-downs that were surely mother-supplied. It was just that this was the outfit he always chose, picking it up off the floor every morning and sniffing it and putting it on again. She wondered how long before he'd get sick of this one outfit, but it had been a month now and she hadn't seen him change yet. Boys can be obsessively focused in their desires, she'd noticed. The things they liked, they tended to repeat again and again and again. "You needed something?" Larry said. Guys were often so eager to do what she wanted, especially when she wore the towel. Larry sat on her bed. She stood in front of him so that her body was directly at his eye level. If she drew the towel up an inch or two, he could probably see her perfectly manicured pubic everything. "Just a little favor," she said. She had met Larry in her intro to lit course. She'd noticed him early on and wondered if he was trying to grow a beard or simply forgetting to shave. She'd seen him on campus. She knew he always wore the same outfit and drove a really big black Humvee. He never spoke to anyone until one day after class he asked if she wanted to come to a party at his frat. A theme party. They were roasting a pig on a spit, grilling hamburgers they called Brontosaurus burgers.
making something called Jurassic Juice. They called it the Slutty Cave Girls Party, which was just so totally offensive. Because it's a party at a frat. Obviously, she would dress slutty. They didn't have to tell her to do that. Did they think she was stupid? But okay, she went. Leather toga, no undies, whatever, and drank Jurassic Juice until it tasted good, and talked to Larry, who used the word circumspect in a sentence, which was impressive. They talked about what was the worst thing about college. The classes, Laura had said. The parking spaces are too small, Larry had said, and Laura felt that familiar, intoxicated, grabby, all-over need where all she wanted was to press herself up against him tightly. But she wasn't yet so drunk that she was going to hoe it up in front of all these people. She invited Larry back to her dorm room, where she gave him a blowjob, and he totally came in her mouth without even asking, which she personally found rude, but whatever. She didn't know what circumspect meant, but sometimes you have to give a guy some credit. That's a good word. "Do you still have your job?" Laura said, by which she meant his fantastic work-study position at the campus computer support center, where Larry spent most of his three-hour shift watching internet videos, occasionally helping some poor professor who didn't know how to hook up a printer. "Yes," he said. "Oh, good," she said, and she stepped toward him, lightly touching her leg to his. The weirdest thing that had happened when she seduced Larry in her dorm room that first time was that at the moment he orgasmed, she felt some odd lump of something suddenly enter her mouth. Something soft, but definitely, surprisingly, solid. She spit it into her hand and found what appeared to be a partially digested piece of Brontosaurus burger, which she assumed came out of Larry, and thus she concluded he had the unique ability to ejaculate his dinner out his penis, which was gross. After that, she requested that Larry do his deposits elsewhere. "So at your job," Laura said, "you can remotely log into any computer on campus, right?" "Yeah." "Perfect. There's a computer that needs to be investigated." Larry frowned. "Whose computer?" "Professor Anderson's." "Oh, man, for real?" She stroked